Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but tune in next week and she'll be back. Our guest today has an Iowa connection, and you may know that we are here in Iowa. Sean Adams is a graduate of Bennington College and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. His fiction has appeared in Electric Literature's Recommended Reading, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, the Normal School Volume 1, Brooklyn, the Arkansas International, and elsewhere. He lives in Des Moines, Iowa, with his wife, Emma, and their various pets. His debut novel is titled The Heap. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Sean Adams.
Thank you, Monica. It's great to be here.
Great. So are you in Des Moines today?
Yes, I am. Yep. Just at home, kind of enjoying the, you know, respite from the snowfall.
Now, I understand that we're going to get like temperature in the 30s for the next 10 days, no more snow. So it's all going to melt before my grandkids get here. So I'm very disappointed about that.
That's a bummer. You know, it's like they're still at the age where they enjoy the snow.
They're coming from Texas and really wanted to have snow when they got here.
A bummer. That's I saw next Monday is supposed to be like 40 degrees or something. It's just, I don't get it.
I know. So how long have you lived in Iowa?
You know, so I've lived in Iowa kind of on and off we've lived here in Des Moines for about 2 years now. Before that I lived briefly in Clinton, Iowa for a little while, and then Iowa City while I was in graduate school, but there's some stops between there too.
So you're not an Iowa native?
I am not. My wife is. I got a job in Clinton, Iowa, and I met my wife there. And then we were kind of like, we lived in Washington for a bit in kind of like the Seattle, Tacoma area. And then I went to graduate school, and then we lived in upstate New York a little bit, which is actually where I'm from. I'm from kind of like the Hudson Valley area of New York.
Well, I was going to ask you what kept you in Iowa after grad school, but obviously your wife.
She works at a community college here. She's a librarian. So, you know, we ended up back here kind of like close to her family. And so that's neat. Yeah.
Oh, great. Great. So this is your debut novel. Was this something that you were working on while you were at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop?
You know, not really. So, like, my final semester, I started it as a short story. What happened was, like, I started it, and I thought, this kind of, like, there's more of this story to tell. I kind of decided to kind of put it away for a little bit, and then I worked on it more after grad school. So basically, like when I finished grad school, I'd been mostly working on short stories there. And then I finished up, and I was in Tacoma with my wife, and we were trying to figuring out what to do. And I started working on it then. The goal was to write a novella, and it turned into a novel.
Now, a novella would be kind of an odd goal to me, because aren't they like the hardest thing to get published?
They are. You know, I just like, I really love short books. So I think some of it was almost just like, some of it was like when I planned to write it as a novella, it wasn't necessarily like it was necessarily for publication or, you know, like with the idea of like, you know, showing it to maybe anyone. I think it was more, you know, that I love these weird little books. I read a lot of novellas, like, you know, it's like there's a lot of like European authors write like almost primarily novellas and things like that. And so part of it was like a goal for myself to kind of just finish something substantial, but not but also, you know, doable. Maybe it was more of a defense mechanism in my mind, you know, like I if I told myself I was only writing a novella, that's the only way I could have finished it.
So this is then the first novel that you wrote, not just the first novel that you've published.
So, you know, I tried at one point to write a novel before, and I finished a draft of it, but, you know, I wouldn't really show that to anyone. So, I mean, I had attempted it in the past, but this was the first time I feel like almost like more in earnest and less in, you know, just like the goal, like the previous time I had tried, the goal had been to write, you know, 50 some thousand words, and it hadn't necessarily been to write something and polish it and actually, like, you know, figure it out. And so once I realized that this project that I was working on wasn't a novella, it was a novel, like, I definitely shifted my focus a bit and took it more seriously. So yeah, I would say that's like the first time I've seriously attempted to write a novel.
And what is the, where's the line between a novella and a novel? Is it just word count?
You know, it's funny. It's like, it doesn't necessarily seem like there is one. I you know, because I've seen definitely, like, I've seen, you know, books that are marketed as novels that are like 150 pages long. And I think of that as more of like kind of a novella length. I think of novellas kind of are split into two groups in my mind. There's kind of like, there are the novellas that are kind of long, short stories, you know, that are like, you know, 70 or 80 pages long and definitely kind of have that feel of a short story that is like, you know, kind of more expansive. And then I feel like there are also novellas that kind of fall in the category of like a short novel, where they feel kind of like a, you know, they're maybe not taking, they're not building such a wide, like a wide reaching world as like a 250, 300 page novel. And yet they also feel like their goal is separate from that of a short story.
Well, it's pretty obvious that you're building a pretty, not necessarily wide, but high
yeah, exactly.
world in the heap.
Yeah.
So, where did this idea come from? So, or maybe what you should do is read the prologue so that the listeners get an idea of what it's about, and then we can talk about the genesis of the project.
Definitely. And so the prologue is called Join the Dig, and basically the gist of it is it's written to be kind of a promotional pamphlet, and you know, it's kind of like, it's very markety and stuff like that. But it's a great thing to read because it really kind of sets the whole scene for like the entire novel. So I'll just read that. Join the Dig. The fall of Los Verticales. Los Verticales, a marvel of modern architecture, an achievement in non-traditional urban planning, a car-free, elevator-enabled society, the city that grew up rather than out, defying directional norms until the day it could no longer. It stood nearly 500 stories tall, bustling with life and excitement. Today, its mountainous remains cover 20 acres of desert land. The relief effort will be colossal, and you can be a part of it. The greatest recycling project the world has ever known. In collaboration with artisans the world over, all non-hazardous materials from the Los Verticales dig site will be reclaimed and reused. This will not be an exercise in mindless rock moving. Each dig hand will be made a curator of debris, a prospector of diamonds in the roughest of rough. Each pitch may reveal a potential work of art. You will not simply dig. Your efforts will make the world a better place. Dig for survivors. Radio disc jockey Bernard Anders was such a touchstone of life inside Los Verticales that residents often called him the voice of the vert. Today he is recognized as something different, the only confirmed survivor of his former city's collapse. His location, unknown. Miraculously, Bernard and his equipment survived the fall. For 10 days he sat silent. Then he tested his microphone and saw the levels rise. Another miracle. He continues to broadcast to this day from a dark hole somewhere deep within the wreckage, taking calls from his legions of devoted listeners and watching the days tick by on a soundboard's digital clock while he awaits rescue. Will yours be the shovel that uncovers him? The latest in dig-related technology. With Bernard's survival playing out on the radio came knowledge that some of the Los Verticales dig site must be electrified. But fear not. The city's founding father from afar, Peter Thisbe, has personally developed a set of shockproof gear for this purpose, including boots, overalls, and special conduction sense shovels that will alert dig hands to any alive electrical currents by way of a whistle built into the shaft. Experience firsthand the new era in digging. All types needed. Not cut out for the pitch and heave life? No problem. The Los Verticales dig effort is an enormous project requiring workers of all skill sets, including drivers, office support staff, supervisors, site managers, event planners, service industry and retail staff, and so much more. If you want to be involved, you will be involved. An excellent compensation package. Though all positions are classified as a volunteer, Peter Thisbe has established the Los Verticales Relief Foundation, which will generously provide each worker at the dig site with a fully weatherized camper, a rehabilitated bicycle, and a small living stipend. And best of all, the beautiful desert views come free of charge. So what are you waiting for? Join the dig and help make a better, more beautiful tomorrow today.
And that is the heap. So a giant building, a totally self-sufficient, not exactly,
yeah,
self-contained.
The entire, you know, like this, like, yeah, this, this basically this enormous skyscraper that is a city unto itself is the gist.
And where did that concept originate?
You know, honestly, so the idea originally in my mind was this idea of, you know, I think it started a lot with that bit about the Bernard, the radio DJ. There was something, like a lot of my stories kind of start off as these little jokes in my head, and then I kind of just decide if I can expand them into a short story or something longer, or, you know, or if they're just a little like funny tidbit that's not really, you know, destined to be anything more than a joke in my head. And so this kind of started with this idea of Bernard, this radio DJ, being buried, and, you know, he's buried, but he can still broadcast. And so that, you know, everyone knows he's survived, and yet, like, he has no way of really, like, he has this completely public-facing life where every, you know, his entire life is broadcast over the radio, essentially, and that, you know, and he can only talk to his brother on the radio, that there's no, he has, like, no escape and no privacy. And so that's kind of where the story started, and then kind of from there, this, like, this idea of Los Verticales, this enormous, like, fully interior city, started to build out kind of after that, I think. And then kind of, and then after that, this idea of, you know, the relief workers that are trying to clean up the collapse of that city. So yeah, so it started out actually, like, which is funny, it started with this idea of a radio DJ trapped and, like, forced to broadcast his entrapment.
So, and the city was built by this mega developer, Peter Thisbe,
yeah,
and he doesn't really seem to take full responsibility for the collapse in some sense. I'm just wondering if that, if you're patterning that on any of our current billionaires, or is there a little social commentary in there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not, I don't necessarily, like, kind of like when I sat down to, like, create him in my mind, I don't necessarily think there's, like, a one-to-one correlation. Somebody who reviewed the book kind of called him a Bezos Elon Musk hybrid, and I was like, oh, that's actually a pretty apt, like, I guess I didn't even think about it that way, but that's a pretty good way to put it. And so, but just kind of, yeah, like, definitely, like, was definitely thinking about just this, you know, this certain type of you know, billionaire that I feel like is, you know, constantly, like, you know, wheeling out these plans, and maybe, but, like, maybe not necessarily, you know, serving humanity for the for good, I guess. Yeah.
Do you think if this happened, would you have been attracted to live in a place like this?
Oh, this is a great question, actually. Yes, I think that, like, there's, like, yes and no. I feel like there is this, you know, it's funny. I just feel like there is this idea of, like, a fully enclosed community that I find actually, like, really thrilling and kind of fun in my mind, even though I know that, like, the logistics of a place like that would be just an absolute nightmare. And there's, I don't know, maybe there's something about the idea of, if you lived in a community like that, it's like, your little corner of it, like, you know, your condo or wherever you live, like, would feel like such a little, like, safe haven, this, like this corner all to yourself, in a way that I feel like if you lived completely isolated, it wouldn't necessarily feel that special to, you know, have your own space. And so I feel like in a weird way, like, a community like that, like, would amplify both of those things. You'd have the community, and you'd also have your, like, your own space. Maybe it would feel, like, more sacred than it would else otherwise.
That's interesting. Now, one of the things that was very interesting about the community beforehand, which actually let me describe a little bit, and you can add in. The book goes back and forth between the perspective of a number of characters on the dig, who are participating in the dig, and the kind of memoirs of the people who lived there, were away during the collapse, and are sort of just hovering around.
Yeah, the displaced travelers. They were all traveling when the collapse occurred, so that they're basically the only, like, other than Bernard, who's under all the debris, they're the only survivors of the collapse, but not because they survived it, just because they were away during it, and they can't seem to let go
of their life. And so they're writing, what life in this community was like, and one of the things that was very intriguing was the sort of the class warfare between the people who lived on the outer edge and thus had natural sunlight and the ones who lived in the interior and never saw the light of day.
Yeah, so the ones who lived in, so it's like kind of like the inner and the outer units. So like it's such a huge building that, you know, they can't just build it out, like, you know, having such a wide base and having to be built, you know, 500 stories tall, they can't simply build it out where, you know, like every unit has a window. And so there are these units that are fully inside, and what they have instead are these things called UV screens, which I think it's like, you know, they recreate, you know, 97% of the window experience by like kind of like basically live streaming, or, you know, not so live streaming the outdoor world, and like kind of projecting UV light in a combination of ways. I mean, it's never fully explained how they work. But, you know, so that's kind of like the interior units don't have true sunlight. And so, yeah, there's constantly like there are these constant struggles between the outer units, which are like naturally the more affluent members of the community because they can afford the units with windows. And then the people who live in the inner units who, like, you know, without having windows are, you know, like have far less means. And so, yeah, but they greatly outnumber the outer units. So, yeah.
And what makes it even worse is sometimes an outer unit ends up becoming an inner unit because they had to widen the base as it went up. And it seems to me like that would be really, really not good.
So like these outer unit residents who like kind of are a bit maybe smug and a bit, you know, kind of entitled, you know, occasionally like near the base they'll basically lose their windows and you know, as the base is expanded, and some will, you know, some of the most affluent will just like, you know, abandon that condo or sell that condo and then buy another outer unit, you know what I mean? But it's also like, but basically like as soon as an outer unit is innerized, it loses so much of its value that like only the most affluent can do that. And so you'll have these kind of like former smug members of the outer community that are kind of then like absorbed into the inner community. like, you know, they have a new time zone. There's a whole issue with the time inside Los Verticales is a very strange thing.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the things that happens, you know, in the later years. So the later years is basically this manuscript that these displaced travelers are writing, and they're more or less just like describing life inside Los Verticales. And one of the chapters concerns this issue of a time change, which is essentially. There was so much traffic because like as it kept growing and growing, there was so much hallway traffic that, you know what I mean, it was kind of like unbearable. Like, you know, the people would stand at the elevators for a long time and just watch elevators go by just completely full. And so they thought, like, you know, we need to figure something out. We need a solution to this like terrible hallway traffic. And so what they did was like the condo board essentially took the UV screens in the inner units and set them on different time zones so that like daytime for an inner unit might be wildly different than daytime for an outer unit. It might, you know, they might be 12 hours behind the quote unquote true time of the outer units. And like, and then the actual inner units might have different time zones themselves. So like two condos right next to each other might be, you know, like one you know, it might be like 6 o'clock in one and, you know, like midnight in the other. So, and that way it cuts down on the traffic because they're just like people are out in the hallways at all times in that sense. Like, but like not as dense. The hallways aren't as dense like that because not everyone's on the same schedule. Wow. So, yeah.
I would think that would be kind of tricky for businesses.
Yeah. it creates this like weird like 24-hour culture inside, which I thought was like, it's like another reason that would be like vaguely appealing, if that makes sense. Like you show up to work at 9 o'clock and because there are businesses inside the Los Verticales. So that's another thing. Like it's like everyone lives, works, and, you know, like, and does everything inside this one building. And so, you know, you show up to work at 9 a.m. and like people are just getting off. And then a few people show up, you know, like when you're about, you know, at lunchtime. And then, you know, a few people leave, at, you know, when you're at 2 o'clock. So like, you know, so it's this bizarre like community, like where, you know, like, yeah, where like people are coming and going constantly. Some people are eating breakfast at the same time as others are eating dinner. So there's like a rich, like kind of like an egg rich, like culinary style inside Los Verticales that can kind of serve any meal time. And yeah, wow. It's goofy.
You really seem to have enjoyed creating this world.
That's like one of those things. It's almost I love, you know, kind of getting into a character's head. And I love reading kind of, you know, I read kind of widely. I recently read Normal People by Sally Rooney, which is a very realist novel about, you know, these two Irish millennials in this kind of, you know, like very much millennial relationship for a series of years. And I love reading stuff like that. But like when I sit down to write, like some of it really is just like, one of the joys I find personally in writing is just building out worlds and like immersing yourself in the strange details of a place that does not exist.
Mm. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sean Adams, author of The Heap. Sean, I wanted to congratulate you because when I was in the middle of reading this, I opened the New York Times Review of Books a couple weeks ago, and there you were.
Yeah, that was that was great.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that, and it was a really wonderful surprise. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's like, you can't do much better than that, in for your debut novel.
No, it was, yeah, that was like I I'd heard about it like a couple weeks before that, you know, somebody was like, oh, you know, you'll be, you know, you're set for a review, and so the first thing I was like very excited, and then there's definitely the few days leading up to it, I was a little bit like, oh man, I hope it's not a really bad review. Yeah.
It was not a bad review, and it was a featured review. It wasn't one of the little ones.
No, you know, yeah, it was like a full page.
Yeah. Isn't that like every writer's dream?
Oh my God. Yeah. No, I have my friends who I went through the writer's workshop with, and like friends that I'm close to around here, but people that I haven't kept in touch with. And for a while, all of a sudden we're like reaching out to be like, congratulations, you know, like, and I don't know, it was an exciting thing to get in there. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So The Heap is written, as I mentioned, from the perspective of a number of characters. And you mentioned that Bernard was the first character, although the book isn't really from his point of view at all.
Yeah.
So who was the first point of view character that you found?
Orville was definitely the first one. So Orville is Bernard's brother. He's basically a worker at the dig site. And so he's digging for his brother basically to try and uncover him. He works with a number of other kind of like quirky dig hands, and they're kind of constantly just like on the heap, which is what they call the ruins of Los Verticales is the heap. That's where that phrase comes from. And then he's kind of just on there all the time with a shovel, kind of digging for Bernard. And then after work every day at like about, you know, like whenever they sign off, he rides his bike to the phone bank, which is just a collection of basically pay phones, where he then calls in to Bernard's show, and they can have their kind of like personal conversation.
And the workers there, including Orville, they're developing a kind of a really insular community as well.
Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, it's like the, yeah, the silly, or not the silly thing, but the weird thing about it is, you know, it's like, so they've got, they live in this, they live in this community called Campertown, and basically, like I mentioned in the, you know, the prologue there, everyone who works on the dig site is given a fully weatherized camper and a rehabbed bicycle. And so basically, it's like around the heap is just this expanse of campers, and that's where everyone lives. That's where all the dig hands live and all the service workers and all everyone who kind of works on this relief effort. And so, you know, there's also tensions there because there's the people who work on the dig that are actually like doing the physical labor of the dig. And then there are people who kind of work in the assistance sector, which is kind of like where like a lot of the administrative tasks related to the dig take place. And then there's, you know, there's a bar within Campertown that's, that services like basically the entire population. It's the only drinking establishment in all of Campertown. So it's kind of always kind of packed. What's funny is like they're kind of like their community actually sort of mirrors in a lot of ways, like the community that was like the community inside Los Verticales is kind of mirrored in Campertown.
And it seems like kind of a sad community.
Yeah, you know, it's another kind of way in which it's mirrored is like kind of in Los Verticales, like people are moving in droves right initially, but then people kind of, you know, the people who were just like, you know, who were interested in the novelty of it, but then realized they don't, you know, they don't actually want to live in a fully interior city. You know, they eventually leave, and so the only people that are coming in are these like extremely devoted, you know, like the people who like really like want this type of lifestyle. And it's kind of the same in Campertown, kind of like basically, you know, like right after the collapse when the relief effort started, a lot of people flocked there, and then you know, they really like kind of took up, you know, the cause, but then over time, seeing that it was like, you know, they like basically hadn't, you know, had been working there for months and hadn't made a dent in really like the heap, you know, a lot of the like more driven people have left. And it's a lot of like people who live in Campertown are kind of connectionless.
Yeah. They basically have nowhere better to go. Nothing better.
Exactly.
To do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it makes a different kind of, like, it's like a, you know, it's a, it, you know, again, yeah, like the two communities kind of mirror each other in that way.
And Orville, being Bernard's brother, is a bit of a minor celebrity.
Yeah, and he doesn't realize it because he's not necessarily spotted in Campertown, you know what I mean? Like, but people, he eventually finds out that, you know, the ratings are through the roof for their daily conversation, you know, that like when Orville and Bernard talk on the phone, you know, they're people start to tune in basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you read a little bit about from the heap to introduce us to Orville?
Yeah, for sure. So this is chapter two, and it is it's basically, yeah, like when we first meet Orville and his friends on the dig site. So I'll read a little bit of that. Orville saw it happen out of the corner of his eye, saw Hans pitch his conduction sense shovel into the rubble, saw him stumble forward and fall, both man and tool disappearing out of view. And he had to admit, it was just a bit cathartic that it should be Hans. Hans, who all morning had been overexerting himself, or more accurately, overexerting his display of just how much he was exerting himself, putting more emphasis into the theatrics of each pitch than into the physical effort of the pitch itself. It was ridiculous, shameless showboating. There were only three of them, Orville, Lydia, and Hans, working this patch, so who was he trying to impress? No, Orville decided. It was more than ridiculous, actually. It was offensive, especially with Orville right there. Because let's be honest, if there was one person who should be allowed a little dramatic display every now and then, it was him, Orville, given that he worked under a denser psychophysical burden than anyone else in the dig effort. But did he play up his circumstances for sympathy? No, never. Orville siphoned all the jittery energy he derived from his personal turmoil directly into the work of his shovel. He might have even called his devotion to the task at hand monkish if monkishness did not preclude its own acknowledgement. The Pep and Hans' step did make sense, at least on one level. He had that morning led his first orientation session for the new dig hands, and apparently it had gone well. They're hungry, Hans said. What he didn't mention was how few noobs there were. When the three of them had gone through the same session 10 months ago, the leaders had had to split people into 5 groups. There were so many. Nowadays, the influx of volunteers had lessened to a steady trickle. Orville imagined a group between 2 and 7 people. He wondered if Hans had mentioned him as a way of endearing himself to them. If he had paused dramatically as he explained Bernard's situation to say how much this weighed on him personally, given that he knew Bernard's own brother, Orville Anders. But Orville wouldn't hold a hypothetical against him. Truth was, Hans was one of his only friends on the dig, and more importantly, he was a man in need. Orville threw down his own conduction tent's shovel and scrambled the 50 or so feet to where Hans had been. Lydia did the same. In the rubble, they found a hole. Lydia loosed a flashlight, clipped to her overalls, and shined it down. Hans sat on a laminate wood floor not too far below. I'm okay, he said. I landed on my tailbone, but I'm okay. Is it a radio studio? Lydia asked. Hans had turned on his own flashlight now, cast it around, shook his head. Living room. Lydia gave Orville an apologetic look. It was a look he'd grown familiar with, one he appreciated and hated at the same time, for how thoughtful and yet pitying it was. Then the two of them crouched down and eased their way in. Hans was right. It was a living room. A whole intact apartment, actually. There was no power, so there was no air conditioning, but it felt nice compared to the heat of the heap's surface. Hans went into the kitchen with his flashlight and checked the fridge. Got beers in here, he said. He tossed a can to Lydia, one to Orville, and then took one for himself. The beers, like the apartment, possessed a coolness by contrast. The three of them sat on the leather couch and drank. It's a nice place, Hans said. No windows, though, Lydia said. Hans cast his flashlight around. Among a preponderance of photographs showing Shanghai streetlight, he found a cracked UV screen. Yeah, that'd be a tough sell. Orville finished his beer quickly and got up. You getting a refill? Lydia asked. Orville shook his head. Gotta check out the back. He left them there and made his way down the hallway into the rest of the apartment. Away from the hole Hans had made, the darkness increased. He found a bedroom, his flashlight illuminating a queen bed, more UV screens on the walls, and an abstract painting above the headboard. They should take it up, send it to the sale. No reclamation necessary. It might be valuable enough to bring in some good money. He'd deal with that later, though. Across the hall from the bedroom was a frosted glass door. The bathroom, Orville predicted, and he was right. What he didn't predict was finding a body in the shower. He walked back to the living room and got another beer out of the fridge and told Hans and Lydia, get on the two-way with Boss. Tell him to bring the doctor. We got a dead.
And that's Sean Adams reading from The Heap.
Now, yeah, so that's the first chapter of Orville's story, basically. Yeah.
Now, this book, when you start out, you know, it just seems like kind of almost a little bit of a dystopian science fictionish, but it actually ends up being more of a mystery suspense thriller.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was that always where you knew it was going?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what I wanted to write and a lot of like what I was trying to do was sort of to do something with a lot of plot and a lot of forward momentum and excitement and stuff like that. Like, I think when I was when I was in grad school, again, I worked on a lot of short stories I love reading short stories and I love writing short stories still a lot of the time. But I also feel like there's a certain amount of, you know, it's like you sit down and you work on a short story for a few months and it's just kind of, it doesn't necessarily like have that kind of maybe. It doesn't necessarily have that, you know, all wrapped up, that kind of intense sort of like thriller energy, at least like a lot of the stories I write don't and a lot of the stories I read don't. And so I think that I wanted to write something that had that kind of feel, that kind of like, you know, where it's like, you know, the chapters end on cliffhangers and, mm-hmm. you know, the twists and turns. And honestly, like there's some of it came from I love just like watching, you know, kind of like a guilty pleasure sort of like police procedural TV shows and stuff like and action movies and things like that.
Right,
and so
I
wanted to bring some of that energy into the project so that it would, you know, it would be weird and it would be interesting and hopefully thought provoking, but also have some of that like intense energy that like a thriller has.
And yeah, it's interesting because short stories today tend to be kind of slice of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that wasn't always the case. There were some, I mean, Edgar Allan Poe, for example.
Oh, definitely.
Wrote short stories that were very much plot. know, that there was and suspense. But is it? But today you don't. I don't think you do see so much of that. At least not the ones that I'm exposed to.
You know, it's because it seems like a pretty wide range. Like I for some time I was reading like you know, it's like kind of like some of the sort of like, you know, maybe like quote unquote pulpier genre magazines, like, you know, Asimov's or the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And I feel like there, a lot of those stories are still like pretty intensely plotted and pretty, you know, like they have that feeling. And I think a lot of like my favorite short story writers, like George Saunders or Kelly Link or, like a lot of writers kind of in that vein where it's sort of, they're like, kind of like bending the, you know, the genre boundaries, if there are any. And I feel like they often work with like pretty substantial plot elements, but no, I definitely feel like, and I also like love those, you know, more slice of life stories where I love like a realist novel that maybe is a little bit more meandering and doesn't necessarily have the plot of, you know, like these people need to find this thing or else.
Yeah. Or somebody dies.
And so, yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's fun to work with that in like, I don't know, maybe that was also partially just like to try and finish, like the goal was really, I was like, I want to write something and I want to feel like it's done. You know, I want when I finish writing this novel, I don't necessarily want to think, you know, like, oh, should I go a little further or should I cut it back a little bit? Like, I want to have like big plotty moments that feel like, you know, like this is the climax, like this is the denouement, like this is, you know, so it was kind of fun to work with that, like the thriller stuff with that.
Yeah. Did you know the twists and turns of the plot ahead of time?
Pretty much. Okay. So like, I think like I discovered like, I you know, I discovered certain like quirks and stuff going through, or like I had to kind of, you know, or there were definitely like stuff and things happened in early drafts where I then was like, you know, this doesn't actually like make any sense, or like I could actually simplify this a lot, you know, this conflict or whatnot. But for the most part, like the big, like kind of plot hinges, like I had kind of built in my head, but I also, and for that reason, I always kind of like, I kept a lot of the planning fairly loose, knowing those kind of like big hinges were there, because I didn't necessarily want it to feel too much like, you know, everything is leading towards one moment that, you know, I wanted to give it, you know, it's like with the later years sections or with some of the like kind of ancillary characters that come in and get like a little POV section. I wanted it to have a feeling of like some free flowingness while also kind of moving ahead.
Tell us about your decision to have multiple points of view instead of like just Orville's. How did that make it easier and how did that make it more difficult?
Well, so yeah, so like I would say that so there's two or three, I guess, central points of view. So there's Orville is like kind of like the driver of a lot of the kind of the main story. And then one of his co-dig hands, Lydia, is another person who gets like a big piece of POV, basically. So she has her own full chapters and she's, you know, she's got her own kind of issue that she's dealing with, kind of like a more political issue. She's serving on this committee, this kind of political committee that's like, it's the Committee for Better Life in Campertown. And it just is this committee that goes nowhere. And it's just people just griping and stuff like that. And she would really like to kind of like take more control, but she's struggling to do that. So she's the second, like, you know, like full POV character. And then kind of, from there, like I would say like the third kind of POV is obviously like the, what we talked about before, the later years sections. And then other characters kind of just come in and get little POV sections too. and so, you know, it was definitely one of those things that it kind of made it a little bit like, because of, you know, it's like, I definitely sat down, like I said before, I definitely sat down and I was like, I want to bring elements of action movies and police procedurals and, you know, and that sort of like those sorts of things that have that kind of intense, like, plot and, you know, forward momentum. But at the same time, you know, it's a novel and it's not necessarily like I, you know, when I was just like when I first started out, it was mostly just Orville's story and I was writing it and I was like, okay, like everything's going according to plan. And yet I'm kind of I myself writing it and I don't necessarily think I'm having enough fun or making enough like weird stuff happening. So the more characters I could bring in, the more or like, you know, the more different the, you know, the different kind of takes I can bring in, the weirder it'll get. And it was one of those things that it wasn't just like, I didn't want to make it weird for weird's sake. I was just sort of like, how did like, I created a whole fake city and then a whole second fake city. And yet this feels very dry. It doesn't quite make sense, you know? So like, so it was that, that idea that I really wanted to kind of like bring in kind of like more perspectives to show just like how strange and like insular this world really is. And so it kind of helped me with that. Like it, there was parts of it that were, you know, like it gave me a chance to kind of like take breaks from one voice and move on to a different voice or, you know, to really build out just in my mind, you know, through one of these displaced traveler sections of like how things worked inside Los Verticales. And that kind of gave me some respite from trying to, you know, figure out the kind of the twists and turns of the plot. But then kind of on the, you know, on the flip side, then there's also this sort of thing where it's like, you know, there's definitely like then the balance of being, you know, it can't just be whenever I feel like it can't just be that I bring in a different perspective whenever I feel like it. It's that, you know, if I'm going to work with these different perspectives, like that kind of changes the rules of the novel and it changes the expectations of the reader. And I can't just, you know, can't three quarters of the way through just like, you know, trim it down so that it's just Orville's story or just Lydia's story or what, whatever, you know? So like, so that was kind of the difficulty was, you know, like kind of like, you know, like bring it in when I wanted to, but also bring it in when like the story called for it or when like, you know, just like the balance of the novel called for it.
Right. Right. Did you write the novel in the order that it's published in or
no?
All right, talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah, for sure. So I mean so I started off like when I wanted to write it as like something shorter, it was just going to be Orville's voice. And so I started writing it and then I started seeing you know, places where Lydia's voice could come in. So I started to write her chapters and kind of like insert them where they would, you know, where they fit into kind of like the timeline. But then kind of like the weirder sections, like the later years, that was like written completely, like kind of like I took a break to kind of like think more about this world and like build that out. So while I was still working on, you know, while I was still working on Orville's storyline, I'd kind of taken like, you know, like I was like taking breaks from that Orville and Lydia, you know, and then writing these like sections one at a time about, you know, life inside Los Verticales. And so, and then kind of ordering them. There is at one point, the novel was structured so that it was like, you know, it's three parts now, but it was structured as, you know, it was structured in more or less the same way, except that between the three parts, there were, you know, it's like it would go part one, where it would be the prologue, part one. And then between part one and part two, it was just all of the later years. And then between part two and part three was this whole thing that was cut out completely.
What was that?
So without giving too much away, it was like previous jobs that had been completed by this group of kind of rogue voice actors that become central to the plot. So they had their own little like kind of interlude too, where like it talked about like their work, basically.
Okay, so yeah, voice actors who are this group is kind of the villain.
Yeah.
And do you know much about voice acting? You know, why did you choose that as your?
Honestly, you know, it's like, again, it was just one of those ideas that I really liked of just this like sort of these like amoral like terrible voice actors that would do any job for money and that are also sort of like militarized and very like much like basically like a cartel Mm-hmm. Or you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, sort of like this, like, sort of voice mafia, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it's sort of,
I mean,
just
what
kind
have
of
you
came...
got against voice actors, Sean?
No, yeah, it was just like sort of like the story kind of called for something, and then kind of the more I built it out, that was sort of when I knew, like, I was like, oh, this is a novel, because if it's taking this turn, like, I definitely have some more to explore here.
Yeah, I want to describe this book, because not only is it a thriller, suspense, sci-fi, or I don't, it's not exactly sci-fi, but is there a word for that aspect of it that's a little...
You know, I always like the phrase speculative fiction.
Speculative, right.
Bigger umbrella than science
fiction. Yeah. So speculative fiction, mystery, suspense, but also almost farce.
Yes. Yeah, farce is also a great word. That there's a lot of elements that are like, I mean, like, that was kind of like my fear when I was like starting to pitch it and, you know, send it to the agents and stuff, was that a lot of pivotal things in the book kind of hinge on things that are just like kind of outright silly, mm-hmm. that, you know, and it's not necessarily like in the world of the book that maybe they're more sinister or they're terrifying or whatever, but so like kind of like that is something that like is like part of the project I imagine of reading a book like The Heap, is that you're kind of taking what the book, you're kind of like, you know, you're going along with some of these things that are just like pretty zany or wacky and like kind of like, you know, like are sort of jokes, and yet they're not treated like jokes.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, Sean, tell us a little bit about your path to publication with The Heap. So how did you pitch it?
I just found I was just lucky to find an agent who just like seemed to like, I mean, some of it is like, I think a lot of that is like, you know, it's like, I just was Googling around for, you know, agents and editors and whatever I could find. And I found this agent who had, you know, worked with a lot of writers that kind of do this sort of like that sort of semi-literary, semi-speculative, you know, semi-satirical sort of thing. And so I queried him, and he was just into it right away. And so that was kind of like, that was like the lucky find, was just finding someone who basically, you know, it's like, you know, who didn't hold that against the book, that that there's like, you know, quite a lot of like quite a lot of it hinges on kind of like silly concepts. How did you
identify that? Were there other books that you said, okay, my book is kind of like this, and then you looked for their agent? Or
that's what I did most of the time. I had met some agents in grad school, and I'd met with, you know, like, we, you know, it's like you have your one-on-one meeting, and like, you know, they read some short stories of mine, but this was really like and then I'd spoken to some other agents who seemed interested, but then, you know, like had suggestions for changing the plot that I didn't necessarily you know, not that I would like wasn't open for changes. We did quite a fair amount of edits with my agent, Kent Wolf, and I basically, but like, you know, it's like, so there are a few though, that I had spoken to that just had these ideas that I thought, like, I'm like, I don't necessarily see, I don't think that that's the project I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And so then when I kind of like spoke to Kent, his suggestions felt very much in line with like the world I had built. Like it seemed to be like strengthening the project that I was doing rather than changing the project I was doing to something maybe more kind of mainstream or marketable.
Right. Right. And at what point did you have like a first draft completed, or were you several drafts in at the point where you contacted him?
So, So what I did was I wrote the first draft over the course of like, you know, several, like I wrote the first draft to kind of like, basically the draft I sent to him was the one that I had kind of like, I'd finished it, then I had polished it myself, several times through, maybe not making like huge substantive changes, but kind of finding, you know, like just basically like tweaking everything so that it, you know, it read as like as cleanly as possible. I'd shown that draft to a few of my friends, And then they kind of gave me some feedback that I incorporated a little bit of that. And then kind of that was the draft that I sent to Kent. So it's funny because it's like, what, like, you know, not wildly different, but it's like significantly different than the final draft. And yet, you know, it was also, you know, it wasn't necessarily like a work in progress.
Okay. All right.
That makes sense. Yeah, like it was a polished version of itself. And like, we changed a lot throughout the editing process with him and then with my editor.
Okay. So you had a fairly polished draft for the agent, and then you worked with the agent, and who made the decision, okay, now it's ready to send out to publishers?
Yeah. So I did a round of edits with him, and then I sent him the edits, and then, like, you know, it's like a round of pretty significant edits. And then he had like just a couple notes based on those edits. And then it was like, once I sent him that draft, he said, all right, let's do it. You know, let's send it to agents and editors. And we found, like, he made a list of like people that he thought would be open to something kind of like a little weirder or a little funnier, a little stranger. And so, yeah. And so then we started kind of submitting it from there.
And was that a long drawn out process, or did you get results pretty quickly?
It's like, it's funny. I feel like it's sort of like the only two versions of this story I feel like I ever hear are like the story where it's like, you know, like it's like some Pulitzer Prize winning novel and they say like, you know, I was turned down from 150 press I landed here, or else that it's the other version, which is, you know, it's like we sent it out and then like 45 minutes later, like we had like six edits, you know. And then it's like, so like mine is actually like falls like probably like a fairly normal process. Like we sent it around, like it went through like two rounds of submissions basically. So like we sent it around to some editors who, you know, had positive things to say about it but didn't necessarily think it was like right for them to pick up. And then we sent it to another round of editors and, you know, and found the right editor.
And you're with William Morrow, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. So that's one of the big boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a great place to land, almost like for a lot of the reasons we're talking about, because I feel like William Morrow does a lot of, you know, it's like they do literary fiction, but they also do a lot of kind of like more kind of genre-y fiction as well. Like they publish, you know, it's like Elmore Leonard and Neil Gaiman and a lot of these other, you know, kind of like these writers that like kind of appeal very widely for people who want to read crime fiction, or like people who usually maybe like read something more, you know, something more like quote unquote literary. So it was like, I felt like a good place to land.
Now, how long was the process from when you started writing until it was ready to submit to publishers?
You know, it's funny. It's like, it's shorter than I think because I moved several times during that process. But like, I'm always like, oh, what was it, like 5 years? But no, it's actually just like a variety of like weird moves. So I want to say it was like, so like, I would say, so like until it was ready to be for out to publishers, I want to say about 2 years, like a year and a half from when I started it.
That's
pretty
short, really.
Yeah, it is. It's just like, there's a few different places in there. Like two and a half, like, yeah, one and a half, 2 years.
Okay, okay.
Trying to do the math in my head. I'm having a hard time with the dates.
And were you writing full time, or did you have a day job during that time?
So I had a few different like little jobs going on. I mean, I think like I spent a decent amount of time writing after grad school. Like that summer I worked basically doing like a copywriting job that had been my job before I went to grad school. And then I then took some time to just like work on writing. My wife got a job out east, and so we ended up moving out there. And so I was kind of doing this sort of part-time freelance stuff. I kind of like lucked into like a pretty like easy position with that. And then, you know, and then so kind of like on and off. And then I was doing some work in a warehouse. So kind of like I was not writing full time. Right. So, yeah. Yeah. And I don't write full time now. I have a very steady kind of like freelance copywriting job that I can kind of do from home here at Des Moines.
Do you think you would ever like just cut those ties and try and make a living as a novelist?
I just don't necessarily see myself making, you know, I mean, I would say like it would be delightful to do that. But I you know, it's like I think that the chances of kind of like of making that work, I don't necessarily know if it would make sense for me to do that, or if it would, you know, like if it would be kind of like a lot of like sometimes I feel like it would be kind of a lot of hustling. It would be like maybe like more work than I do now to just like writing and then
plus the
work.
Pressure.
Yeah. Like I have a nice, so my job right now, I'm like, I kind of like do like, I write for a deal site and I write, you know, I'm allowed to write kind of like snarky, like funny kind of copy for these products that we sell. And so it's actually pretty fun. And it's, you know, so the idea of kind of, the idea of like abandoning that and having like the regularity of that gone, doesn't necessarily appeal to me. I also find that when I have something else going on, like it's like the pressures of writing are a little bit alleviated. Like if I can find something where it's like it's not necessarily like the job I have right now doesn't take up all of my time, and but it also takes up enough time that, you know, like if I have a rough day editing, or if I just like if I'm having a hard time like figuring out what to do in a certain scene or with a certain character, that I don't necessarily like, I can at least fall back on him. It's like, well, I got my work done today. You know, like I did my job.
It sounds kind of like an ideal job.
Really is, yeah.
Yeah. Have you, I know a lot of writers also teach, or at least at workshops or something like that. Do you do any of that?
Not right now. No, I taught when I was in grad school for my second year. I taught a fiction writing class at Iowa. And that was like a lot of fun and I really enjoyed it. And yet, like, I think that kind of, like if there was, you know, if there was like a creative writing opportunity, you know, around here, a creative writing teaching opportunity, like I wouldn't necessarily like, I wouldn't balk at it, but I'm not necessarily like, not really on the hunt for that right now.
You know, the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, of course, is one of the premier MFA programs, I think, in the country for writing, creative writing. And it used to have a reputation for being a little harsh. a little hard on the participants. Did you find that?
Not really. I think that like, it's like, you know, it's a place full of writers. So you're going to have some like, you know, it's not always going to be like I had some harsh workshops and I had some not harsh workshops. I had some, you know, it's like, I had some workshops that I'd rather forget, you know, or I'd like to forget. But I also had some workshops that were like very affirming. And I think some of it that is something that's interesting is like a lot of the times, even if people are saying, you know, like, oh, like you need to like cut this story in half and rewrite the entire ending, like being in a room of people who are just taking your work extremely seriously is like very refreshing to me. You know, it's like sort of like, there is this like this feeling of like that kind of like goes a long way, especially for me. It's just like, you know, hearing people say like, even if they're saying, you know, like this isn't working, the fact that they're taking it seriously as a thing that could work is exciting.
Well, that's a very, I'd say, mature perspective on that. And Sean, we're out of time. And
great.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was wonderful. Yeah.
Oh, great. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.